The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
The American public is not that interested in foreign policy because it doesn't matter that much. This is a playground for the elites. Right? And as I said to you before, it's a giant jobs program. And the end result is that as long as large numbers of Americans are not being killed, and as long as people don't think they now have to pay a lot of money to fight these wars, they're willing to let the wars go on. And then my final point to you would be the elite in this country is really brilliant at bamboozling the public into thinking it's necessary to spend all this money on defense and fight all these wars. Threat inflation is our business. There's nobody that's better at threat inflation than the American foreign policy establishment.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and you're listening to the Lawfare Podcast, October 20th, 2018. In recent decades, both Democratic and Republican administrations have tried to guide other countries towards systems of liberal democracy. But international relations theorist John Mearsheimer's latest book, The Great Delusion: Liberal Dreams and International Realities, says that strategy has made the U.S. a highly militarized state, fighting wars that undermine peace, harm human rights, and threaten liberal values at home. Last week at the Hoover Institution's Washington office, Jack Goldsmith sat down with Mearsheimer to talk about the book. They discussed why administrations have tried to promote democracy, how that strategy has bolstered non-democratic governments in the international sphere, and whether a more restrained foreign policy could better serve U.S. interests. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 357, John Mearsheimer on the Great Delusion.
John, thanks for coming. I'm just going to start off by asking you to tell us what the book's about.
Basically, this is a book about American foreign policy in the post-Cold War period. And my principal goal was to try to explain why our foreign policy has been largely a failure, especially since 2001. And my basic argument is that we've pursued this foreign policy, which I call liberal hegemony. And to understand liberal hegemony, you have to understand the relationship between liberalism, nationalism, and realism. So in a very important way, it's a book about the relationship between those three isms. And the core argument is that nationalism and realism beat liberalism, i.e. liberal hegemony, at every turn. And that explains why we're in so much trouble today.
So you need to explain for the audience what you mean by liberal hegemony. You're not talking about Republicans versus Democrats.
Yeah, let me just be very clear in what I mean when I use the term liberal. I'm not talking about Democrats as liberals and Republicans as conservatives. I'm using the word liberalism in the Lockean sense of the term. And in my story, both Republicans and Democrats are liberals. This is not to say there aren't differences between the two, but they're both liberals. We live in a liberal democracy. And in that sense, people from both parties are thoroughly liberal. Now, what exactly is liberal hegemony? My argument is that liberal hegemony is a policy, it's a foreign policy, that's designed to remake the world in America's image. And there are three elements involved. The first and the most important is to spread democracy all over the planet. And this, of course, leads us to go around the world knocking off regimes, toppling authoritarian leaders, and trying to promote democracy. That's number one. Number two is to promote an open international economy and do everything we can to get countries all around the world deeply enmeshed in that open international economy. And then the third goal is to also get countries all around the world deeply enmeshed in the international institutions that we, the United States, largely created after World War II. So those are the basic goals. And the belief is that if you can make the world look like America, right, the end result will be, number one, you will eliminate human rights violations all around the world, because as you all know, liberal democracies don't violate human rights or individual rights on a massive scale. And if the world is comprised of only liberal democracies, the problem is taken off the table. Second, if the world is comprised of nothing but liberal democracies, you will get peace, because liberal democracies don't fight each other, according to the liberal story. And once you get peace, the terrorism problem is taken off the table, and the proliferation problem is taken off the table. And then the third great benefit is you make the world safe for democracy. As you know, inside any liberal state, you're going to have elements that are unhappy with liberalism. They may be communists during the Cold War or what have you. And those people who don't like liberalism seek allies in other countries, i.e. communists looking to the Soviet Union to help them. But if the world is comprised of only liberal democracies, those disenchanted people inside your liberal democracy have no foreign allies. Again, Woodrow Wilson referred to this as making the world safe for democracy. So this is really what liberal hegemony is all about.
So can you walk us through the catalog of failures that are attributable to this commitment?
Well,
just the highlights.
Yeah, I think there are three big highlights. The first is the Bush Doctrine. And the Bush Doctrine, of course, was all about spreading democracy in the Middle East. Iraq was just the first stop on the railroad line. We were going to promote democracy in Syria, in Iran, and so forth and so on. And of course, that was a catastrophic failure. The amount of blood that we have on our hands, given what's happened in the Middle East, is just hard to describe. Second great failure is NATO expansion and EU expansion and our efforts to take those two institutions, NATO and the EU, and march them up to Russia's doorstep and create a giant zone of peace in Western and Eastern Europe. This, of course, led to the crisis over Ukraine. Most Americans believe that Russia's responsible for the Ukraine crisis. I don't believe that for one second. The United States and its West European allies are responsible for the crisis over Ukraine, because we thought, foolishly, because we were thinking like liberals, not like realists, that we could actually march an alliance that was a mortal enemy of the Soviet Union right up to Russia's doorsteps. And of course, it all blew up in our face. And then the third great policy failure is engagement with China. Most of the proponents of that view, who thought that engaging China would turn it into democracy, and then we would have love, peace, and dope from there on out, have now admitted that it was a failure. And instead, what we did was help create a behemoth.
Okay, so before I get to questioning some elements of that thesis, one reason that's often given for why this liberal hegemony strategy might work is that it worked after World War II. It's every element I think that you describe, remaking the world in the American image, an open economy, commitment to international institutions, was, now maybe you want to say that wasn't an era of international hegemony because there was a bipolar situation with the Soviet Union. I'm just wondering, how do you distinguish what the United States did just after World War II, which seemed relatively successful, maybe you want to contest that, to what happened after 89 or 2001?
Well, let me just say generally what we did after World War II up till the end of the Cold War was extremely successful. There's no question about
but
that.
But it seems to have the patina of liberalism as an element of foreign policy. So why am I wrong about that?
The key word is patina.
Okay, all right. Yeah.
Look, in the book, I argue that the only world in which you can have the United States pursuing liberal hegemony is a unipolar world. It's very important to emphasize this, because in a unipolar world, where the United States, by definition, is the only great power, is the sole pole, it is free to pursue liberal hegemony. Otherwise, it has to behave in a realist fashion. So if you're in a bipolar world, you're in a bipolar world like we were during the Cold War, you have to act largely according to the dictates of realism. Now, with regard to those three elements, spreading democracy, an open international economy, and international institutions, first of all, there's no question that if we could turn a state like Germany or Japan into a democracy, we would do it. Ceteris is paribus, you'll take a democracy over an autocracy every time.
But we spent resources trying to make that happen.
Not great resources, and we were willing to live with some real thugs during the Cold War, and we were oftentimes willing to behave in very heavy-handed manners, right? So spreading democracy was not a high priority, right? What was of the highest priority was balancing against the Soviet Union. Now, with regard to international institutions, there's no way in a highly interdependent modern world you can get away without having institutions. So we created NATO. NATO was not a liberal institution. NATO was created to fight the Cold War. And in fact, lots of the institutions that we created, including the EU, were largely created for security reasons. This is not to say that they are not also liberal in a certain sense. And in fact, institutions can be both realist and liberal at the time. But the fact is that during the Cold War, virtually everything we did was designed to deal with the Soviet Union.
Right. And so those seem like cases where it's hard to tell how much of the strategy is being driven by realism and with a patina of liberal hegemony. And one might say, I assume you'll disagree with this, but just for purposes of argument, that a lot of the 9/11, post-9/11 strategies that you talked about, say the response in Afghanistan and the response in Iraq, however misplaced it was driven not by that the desire for democracy was kind of the trailing reason, and that really we went to Afghanistan because that was the source and the location of this massive attack on the homeland, and we thought we had to go in and clean it up. So I'm just wondering how can you tell when these policies are driven by this liberalism impulse as opposed to some realist impulse?
Yeah.
And there's often mixed motives, I assume, and different people have different motives.
Well, let's just talk about Afghanistan, okay, Iraq, and the Bush Doctrine more generally. Mm-hmm. There's no question, just to take Iraq, that we went into Iraq in large part because we wanted to deal with the terrorism problem and the proliferation problem. As you remember, the Bush administration thought that Saddam was joined at the hip with terrorists and might give weapons of mass destruction to terrorists. So I agree completely with you when you say that that was the reason we went into Iraq. But we went into Iraq with the thought in mind that we could solve that problem by turning Iraq and its neighbors into liberal democracies. That would create a giant zone of peace in the Middle East. It would take the terrorism problem and the proliferation problem off the table. So it's a liberal solution to some very nasty problems, right? A good realist like me is mainly concerned about the balance of power. And when you start talking about invading countries like Iraq, right, I say to myself, you're really asking for big trouble.
Yeah.
This is like going into Vietnam or the Soviets going into Afghanistan. I used to argue during the Cold War, when the Soviets went into Afghanistan in 1979, virtually everybody in the national security establishment was aghast. They thought this was the end of the world. The Soviets were on the march. I said, this is dead wrong. The Soviets just jumped into a giant briar patch. You actually want to invite the Soviets to invade Afghanistan, just like they should have been very happy about the fact that we went into Vietnam. And as I used to tell the Chinese when I first started going to China in the early 2000s, you should be very thankful that the Americans have invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. And you should tell the Americans that they should stay in Iraq and Afghanistan until they win, because they'll be forever wrecking their economy and ruining their military at the same time.
But how do you, just to go back to the World War II analogy, so, you know, it wasn't just Germany and Japan. We spent a lot of resources. There were those early covert actions. There was the Marshall Plan, especially in Italy and in Southern Europe, to try to keep the communist hands off of it. And we were trying to promote something like a democracy there, I think it's fair to say. Is the difference that the aim there was ultimately to balance against the Soviet Union, and that it had this realist justification, even if we're pursuing these liberal, using these liberal tactics, whereas in Iraq it took on a a life of its own? Would that be the way to think about it, or some other way?
Yeah, I think just with let's go back to World War II
and
the immediate aftermath.
Right.
The United States quickly figured out, I'd say by December 1947, that it had to balance against the Soviet Union, that the Europeans were in no position to do it, certainly Germany.
Right.
So we began to move in a big way, creating NATO in 1949. And everything we did was designed to deal with that Soviet threat. Now, part of the reason that we created democracies at the time, and the CIA, of course, was heavily involved in this, was because the alternative to democracy was communism. Because, as most of you know, in the 1930s and during World War II, it was the left that stood up to fascism. And the left, therefore, had a lot of cachet in places like France and Italy. And we were very fearful that the left would win, and that the left, if it won in Italy or won in France, would form an alliance with the Soviet Union. So promoting democracy had a very important strategic rationale. This is not to deny your point that it also fit very neatly with our liberal worldview.
But it had a different strategic rationale.
Strategic rationale. Again, what you want to remember about the Bush Doctrine is that the basic aim of the Bush Doctrine was to create a giant zone of peace by making the Middle East look like a bunch of little Americas.
Right. So I have to say I'm convinced by, especially when we move off, even with Iraq is a good example, Afghanistan is a good example, but humanitarian intervention, especially the strikes in Libya, I think, are a great example for you. They're driven by liberalism with disastrous results. And accepting all of your examples, there's a puzzle, isn't there? Why do we keep doing this? What grip does this attitude have on, really, as you call it, the foreign policy elite? It crosses political boundaries. Where does it come from? Why does it have this grip? And why don't we learn? I mean, there's a lot of learning to be had in reading your book, but why didn't the government figure that out on its own?
Yeah, it's a great question. Just to be very clear before I answer Jack's question, I believe the Republicans and the Democrats are Tweedledee and Tweedledum on foreign policy.
Right.
I just hope that's clear.
Yeah. I meant to say that. If I didn't,
meaningful difference between the two parties with regard to foreign policy. They both embrace liberal hegemony. I think there are a number of reasons. First of all, liberalism is hardwired into the American psyche, right? Americans are just deeply committed to promoting liberalism around the world because it's just the way we are, right? That's one thing.
But can I stop you there? Is that because every nation has a natural tendency to replicate its domestic structures abroad, or is that something uniquely American?
It's the former.
Okay.
Right. The United States is a fundamentally liberal country at home, and it does try to export its foreign policy. And it makes perfect sense. If you're an American, you're very proud of the fact that you live in this great liberal democracy, and you believe that America is exceptional, and if you can make everybody else look like us, it'd be a much better world. I mean, it's that mentality that's driving us, for sure. But just to get to your question, which is a really great question, I think there are a number of factors at play here, Jack. I think, first of all, once you get into these conflicts, it's almost impossible to get out. I mean, look at Afghanistan. It's the longest war in American history. We got out of Iraq, but then we got back in. This is one of the reasons I was so opposed to going into Iraq to begin with. I knew that once we got in there, we'd never get out. So I think it perpetuates itself for that reason. Second, I think it's a basic giant jobs program for the elite here in Washington, right? I mean, there are just all sorts of people in Washington who I run into all the time who want to run the world. If you're trying to run the world, it just creates lots of jobs and lots of opportunities. So it is a jobs program. And the other thing is we have no accountability in the American system. You can screw up big time in foreign policy and you really don't get punished for it. Right, you go to a think tank, you stay there for a couple of years, and then you're back in the government again.
Well, why is that? And so all of these things are puzzling, aren't they? But why is there no accountability in the foreign policy establishment? Is that true across the board in the government, or is there something unique about the foreign policy
establishment? There's something unique about the foreign policy establishment. And that is the fact that there's this real disjuncture between the public and the elites. And the fact is the United States is the most secure great power in the history of the world. And the public intuits this. They understand that we're separated from the rest of the world by two giant moats. We have thousands of nuclear weapons, And here we are in the unipolar moment where, by definition, we're the only great power on the planet. Just think about this. We're the only great power on the planet. We have thousands of nuclear weapons, and we're separated from the rest of the world by giant moats. Does it get any better than this? Right? So when people say the American public really is not interested in foreign policy, they're correct. The American public is not that interested in foreign policy because it doesn't matter that much. This is a playground for the elites, right? And as I said to you before, it's a giant jobs program. And the end result is that as long as large numbers of Americans are not being killed, and as long as people don't think they now have to pay a lot of money to fight these wars, they're willing to let the wars go on. And then my final point to you would be, the elite in this country is really brilliant at bamboozling the public into thinking it's necessary to spend all this money on defense and fight all these wars. Threat inflation is our business. There's nobody that's better at threat inflation than the American foreign policy establishment.
So going back to a question I meant to ask earlier, is this, you define liberal hegemony, as I think you do, as only being possible in a unipolar era.
Correct.
Is that right? So you focus on post-89 and really post-2001 in the book. Is there a precursor to this? I mean, was the Wilson era, was there another period of American liberal hegemony, or is this a recent, is this really post-1989 or post-2001?
Yeah, my argument is that it's post-89 because we've never had unipolarity before. But to sort of pick up on your point about Wilson and other cases, there's no question that given what a thoroughly liberal country the United States is, that that liberal impulse is always there. So even when you're in a bipolar world or a multipolar world, the inclination to follow liberal policies is there. And occasionally you will pursue a liberal policy. And my argument, of course, is that you'll get whacked on the snout because we live in a world where realism and nationalism are the two dominant forces. And liberalism gets you in big trouble, especially in bipolarity and multipolarity.
It might be worth explaining just for the general audience what you mean when you say realism and nationalism trump liberal hegemony when they conflict, that those are the real motivators of action. Can you just flesh that out for us a little
bit? Yeah, sure. Let me focus on nationalism versus liberalism.
Yeah, that's a better one.
I believe that nationalism is the most powerful political ideology in the world. I believe it's no accident that we live in a world that's populated with nation states. I think that the United States is a thoroughly nationalist country. Americans are very nationalistic. When you hear Americans talk about American exceptionalism is American nationalism at play. When Madeleine Albright, who is a card-carrying liberal, says that we are the indispensable nation, we stand taller, we see further. Just think about those words. We, as opposed to the other, we stand taller, we see further. That means we are superior to other. There's American exceptionalism. Madeleine Albright is saying we Americans, we as a nation state have the right, we have the responsibility, and we have the power to run around the world and reorder the politics in different countries in a liberal way. But that's very nationalistic thinking. Very important to understand that, okay? Now, why do I believe that nationalism is more powerful than liberalism? For one very simple reason, having to do with human nature. You have to decide, when you think about human beings, whether you think they're social animals at their core who carve out space for their individualism, or you think they're individuals who form social contracts. That's the $64,000 question you have to ask yourself. Liberalism assumes that we are individuals at our core who form social contracts. Nationalism assumes we are tribal from the get-go. We are born into nations, we're born into social groups, we're born into tribes, and we carve out space for our individualism. Liberalism is wrong. And nationalism is right. We are tribal animals, right? We belong to groups, and we have tremendous loyalty to those groups. This is not to say we can't carve out room for our individualism, right? But we're social animals. So when you get the United States of America going into a country like Iraq or Vietnam or the Soviets going into Afghanistan, nationalism is automatically going to come to the fore in that country you have invaded, because those people are going to say, we are a sovereign nation state. We believe in self-determination. We do not want the United States coming in and telling us what to do. And think about how we react to the the Russians interfering in our elections. They do not have any right, we believe, to interfere in an American election. It's a violation of our sovereignty. That's nationalism at play. Nationalism dominates liberalism.
Okay. Okay, good. But how does this play out? How does that idea play out in sort of American foreign policy failures? When we try to invade on these principles, it often doesn't work because we simply can't go in there and impose this form of government, because the impulse to nationalism resists that? Is that the point?
Yeah. Okay. But look, American foreign policy, as I said to you before, American foreign policy in the era of liberal hegemony has a principal goal, has three goals. But the principal goal is to promote liberal democracy around the world. It's to knock off authoritarian regimes and turn them into liberal democracies. Okay? That means that the United States of America is going to interfere with the sovereignty of other countries. And this is going to cause problems not only in the Middle East with the Iraqs and the Irans and the Saudi Arabias. It's going to cause problems with the Russians and with the Chinese. If you go to Russia or you go to China today and you talk to them about whether they think it's a good idea that America is promoting democracy in either Russia or China, they will tell you in no uncertain terms that this is categorically unacceptable. They recoil at the idea of us interfering in their politics as much as we recoil at the idea of them interfering in our politics. This is nationalism.
Right. So on this point about the Russians recoiling to us interfering in their politics as much as we recoil to them interfering in ours, I think is a fundamental point. This is, for me, when I read realism literature versus liberalism literature, realism, for me, has two foundational elements. One is it tends to assess situations in an amoral way, not to make normative judgments about various forms of life, just in trying to understand international relations. And two, what you just said, and you make this point over and over again about the moving NATO east and the impact that had, and if we had just imagined, as many people argued, that it was going to have this devastating impact on Russia and cause it to react in a very harsh way. Tell me if this is accurate. Realists tend to think in terms of seeing through the eyes of the enemy and taking that very seriously in a kind of cold and amoral way. And my sense is that liberal internationalists don't do that as much. They, and I don't know if this is fair or not, I wonder what you think, that they tend not to think, how is this going to be seen from the other side, and tend just to do what they think is right. Is that a fair characterization? Which part of that would you disagree with?
I agree with everything, and I'll give you the logic that I see that sits behind it. Realists basically treat states as black boxes. There are no good guys or bad guys in the realist story. And realists assume that states, even your own state, often has to do terrible things because the principal goal is survival, and survival requires you to sometimes do immoral things for purposes of maximizing your chances of survival. There are no good guys and bad guys in the realist story. Therefore, it's quite easy for a realist to put him or herself in the shoes of the other side.
Right.
Liberals, on the other hand, divide the world into good guys and bad guys. I'm sure that most of you in this room share that view. You believe that liberal democracies are the good guys and authoritarian states are the bad guys. And when you have that worldview, and you're in a liberal state and you're dealing with an authoritarian state, it's virtually impossible for you to put yourself in the shoes of that authoritarian state. And in fact, you think that you're a benign hegemon. Right. I've talked to Mike McFaul, who was the American ambassador to Moscow from 2012 to 2014. And he was shocked by what happened in February 2014 when the Ukraine crisis blew up, because he told Putin and Putin's lieutenants on numerous occasions when he was the ambassador that they really had nothing to fear from NATO expansion, because the United States was a benign hegemon. It had benign motives. And I believe that Mike believed that completely. But from the Russian point of view, the United States did not look like a benign hegemon, especially since the United States was talking ultimately about regime change in Russia. But it was, I believe, almost impossible for Mike to understand that, because he's such a thoroughgoing liberal. Whereas for a realist like me, it makes perfect sense. This is why George Kennan and virtually all the realists said from the get-go that NATO expansion is going to lead to disaster, because they could put themselves in the shoes of the Russians.
So you talk at the end of the book about the case for restraint, as you call it, which is, I think it's fair to say, the realist prescription for American foreign policy, which is a restrained foreign policy. Could you outline that?
Well, just imagine what the world would have looked like from, let's say, 1990 up to the present, if I had been the president of the United States and had been in charge of American foreign policy. Don't worry, that was never going to happen. We would have had no NATO expansion, and we would today have much better relations with the Russians. The situation in the Middle East would be much more stable. We would not have invaded Iraq. We would not have helped kill Colonel Gaddafi in Libya. We would not have gotten deeply involved in Syria, all these escapades. And I think the end result is that many fewer people would have died. Many fewer Americans would have died. We would have spent much less money. I also would have pulled all our troops out of Europe when the Cold War ended. I find it unacceptable that we spend all this money defending Europeans who are perfectly capable of defending themselves when we have such great needs in this country. You go to airports like LaGuardia and LAX, they're basically third world airports. You go all around the world and people have first world airports. The amount of money we've poured into these wars is remarkable. So we would have had a much more restrained foreign policy based on the fact that we respected the power of nationalism, and we're mainly concerned with the balance of power.
And how do you, I tend to agree with those judgments, but they depend on counterfactual assessments. And I think it's easier to make the counterfactual assessment in the Middle East because we seem to have created such a mess. But it just seems to me harder to know. I agree with you that expanding NATO eastward seemed to invite trouble and to seem to threaten the Russians in a way that may have been unnecessary. But the combination of not expanding NATO, but disbanding it, how do you know in your counterfactual world that wouldn't have led to Russian aggression? I mean, how do you think about that counterfactual?
Russia was a complete basket case in the 1990s. Even today, there's virtually no chance that Russia is going to conquer Eastern Europe. They've been there, done that. It did not work out very well. They got out of town, and the last thing they want to do is go back in. Furthermore, Russia is a declining great power. Largely for demographic reasons, but also for economic reasons. But let's assume that I'm wrong. Let's assume that, they have some formidable military power. Why can't the Europeans defend themselves? They have many more people than the Russians have combined. They have much more wealth, and they spend a lot more on defense, despite the fact that they don't spend that much on defense. Why are we defending them? I agree with Barack Obama when he said we should have concentrated on nation building at home, not spending all this money on wars that, number one, never end, and number two, that we lose.
Okay, so that's a lot of what you said today sounds like some of the things that President Trump advocated for in the campaign trail. You don't talk much about President Trump. He was, first of all, very much against elitist control of U.S. foreign policy. He is very skeptical of NATO. He's skeptical in attitude about excessive U.S. international engagement, even though he engaged in humanitarian intervention twice in Syria. So I just wonder what the relationship is between your thesis and the Trump foreign policy, if you can, you know, state what that is. It's kind of hard to tell. And more generally, how do you assess the Trump foreign policy from the perspective of, is it committed to liberal hegemony or something else going on?
Yeah, a lot of questions.
I know. So answer them all, please, if you can. So, answer any of the ones you want, and I'll follow up.
If I answer one, you can, don't answer two, you can come back at me on two. First thing to say about President Trump is that when he was candidate Trump, he ran against liberal hegemony. Yeah. Remember, I said there were three elements to liberal hegemony: spreading democracy all over the world. He made it clear we were getting out of the business of doing that. Number two, purveying a open international economic order. He made it very clear that he likes tariffs, and he was interested in encountering this open international economic order, which he thought had hurt us. And with regard to institutions, he does not like NATO. He does not like the EU. He does not like the WTO.
NAFTA, list.
On and on. I think one of the first things he did when he became president was to throw the TPP in the garbage.
Right.
So he doesn't like institutions.
Right.
I often say, I think as candidates go, he was the most radical foreign policy candidate in American history. I mean, he ran against the establishment. And by the way, have you ever asked yourself, why did he win? He won because large chunks of the American people understand that our foreign policy is bankrupt. Right? And by the way, Barack Obama ran against liberal hegemony as well, although liberal hegemony defeated him once he was in office.
Although by the end of his term, he basically had admitted, I think in the last two or three years, especially after Libya, he felt burned by it.
Yeah, he felt burned by it. There's no question. And then the famous interview with Jeff Goldberg in The Atlantic, I think, captures that very nicely.
And he resisted those impulses for the last 2 years.
Right. So what you have here now, given that almost everyone in Washington is committed to liberal hegemony, is you have Trump and maybe a handful of others who are up against the establishment. And the question is, who's going to win? Remember, this was the situation that obtained with Obama, and Obama lost. I think there's nobody with as much agency as Donald Trump, and I think if there's anybody who can beat back liberal hegemony, it's him. But the argument I would make, Jack, is I think liberal hegemony is done for it anyway, and it's not done for it because of Donald Trump. It's done for it because of the rise of China, because you want to remember, my argument is you can only have liberal hegemony in a unipolar world. And we are, or I would argue we already have, moved out of a unipolar world with the rise of China and the resurrection of Russian power. We now live in a multipolar world. So we're going back to realpolitik.
And what does that mean for, so we're going back to realpolitik because we live in this multipolar world. What does that mean concretely for the role that human rights rhetoric plays in our foreign policy? Obama kind of dropped it, actually, to a surprising degree. Trump certainly isn't mentioning it. Do you think that means the human rights element of our foreign policy that goes back, I guess, to Carter, do you think that kind of goes by the wayside? It certainly is not a driver of policy. Is that right?
Yeah. My argument is that liberalism, which would include an emphasis on human rights.
So I just meant that as an element of liberalism.
Yes.
Right.
Will always be there to describe our foreign policy, no matter how realpolitik it is. I often say that during the Cold War, the United States acted in a realpolitik way and disguised it with liberal rhetoric, right? So the rhetoric will always be there. The argument I'm making is that we actually behaved in a liberal fashion during the post-Cold War world, but those days are gone.
I see.
Now, one could argue that there are two real problems that liberal hegemony faces. Number one is the rise of China and the resurrection of Russian power. That's one. And number two is it's so clear now that the policy has failed. And given the fact that Donald Trump is in the White House and he's been pounding at liberal hegemony, that sort of 1-2 punch has, in a very important way, finished it off.
Okay. Thank you very much. That was a great discussion.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Hoover for providing audio of the event. If you haven't yet, please take a moment to share the Lawfare Podcast on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts. The Lawfare podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And until next time, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.